Well, the 20-second rule is if you put a 20-second barrier between you and doing something you don't want to do, you're less likely to do it. And if you make something 20 seconds easier, then it makes it easier. So, for example, I actually could have chocolate chip cookies tonight. I suspect there's butter, there's sugar. I don't know if there's chocolate chips, but the barrier stops me from doing it. So if I know I want to work out on Saturday, I wake up in the morning, I put on my workout clothes. It's just one less barrier to working out because I'm already in the clothes. And if I want to go someplace else, I say, I have to change into something else. Oh, I may as well just work out.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, we create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Jim Estile, a serial entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist with an incredible track record of building and scaling companies. He grew his first business to over $2 billion, sat on the founding board of BlackBerry during its meteoric rise, and after a career in tech and having earned the right to do anything he wanted, he decided to be the CEO of an appliance company. But what drew me to Jim wasn't his business success. It was a video he posted about something he called monk mode. And trust me, you're going to love it. Jim provides a masterclass in leadership and entrepreneurship and shares practical advice on time management, staying focused, building strong teams, and the importance of using your wisdom over your work ethic as you get older. Jim has been a vocal critic of the business community for not giving enough back. And he talks about how this leads to so many successful people struggling to find purpose even after they've achieved everything they set out to do. Now, I can't tell you how many moments during this conversation I thought, holy shit, I have to go talk to Jill about that. I have to take that idea back to my clients. That's a new habit I need to build. That's a new question I can ask. It was one of those rare conversations that bobs and weaves, goes in unexpected directions, and somehow gives me exactly what I needed to hear at this point in my life. Please enjoy Jim Estile. All right, Jim, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy you could be here.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to dig into a lot of the amazing things you've done, Jim, the companies you've started and sold, the books you've written. But the reason that I was so drawn to your story was a video you posted about something I had never heard of before called Monk Mode. And I'm wondering if we could start with that. What is monk mode and what's your version of it?
Well, monk mode for me is just being completely off grid, completely disconnected. So I went to a property which has no internet, no electricity, no cell service. And everyone says, Jim, you're so self-disciplined. But I am self-disciplined because I set my life up to be self-disciplined. Like the example, I think I might even use it in the video, is the reason I don't eat chocolate chip cookies when I go home is there is no chocolate chip cookies. And so set yourself up with things. So I went to this property for 3 weeks. I fished every day. I ate fish every day. I actually got to a point where I didn't want to fish because I was sick of eating fish. I did spend time meditating. I went swimming every day. I canoed and paddled around the lake every day. I maintain a little trail network, so I did that. So a component for me that helps is to have a fairly physical, aggressively physical part. So it's not just sitting idle. But when you're off grid, everything takes time. I slow down. I mean, without the internet, like, how do I even know what temperature it is? Right now, I check my phone to see the temperature. I go out and say, oh, that's pretty cool. But is that, you know, what is that? I don't know. I have to check my phone and whatnot. So it stops me from checking the phone and it gets me out of the, I call it a Twitter personality. I know it's X now, but it's flitting from one thing to another because in the time we're together, I'll be getting a bunch of emails and so I'll flip from email to email, and then someone's going to be in my office, and I'm going to have a phone call, and then I'm going to be next meeting, and everything's pound, pound, pound. This just makes me very much in the moment.
So there's so much about that that I love, and I've got a lot of questions. How long have you been doing this?
I have been doing it maybe for 15 or 20 years, but not always for 3 weeks. Mm. It's also healthy for my business because, if people absolutely need to get a hold of me, we do have a way they get a hold of me. But oddly enough, business went on and we still kept selling freezers and fridges, and people kept, you know, the business kept on clicking. It helps people rise to actually make decisions and do things. And then when I come back, I find I spend more of my time doing the things that I should be doing rather than the things other people should be doing, because I too tend to get into the nitty gritty of life. Like when you're done here and you say, "Oh, Jim, can I get a freezer?" You know, me, I'd be drilling in and saying, "Oh, okay, great. Let me get your freezer," where maybe I have someone else who should get you the freezer.
Right. Yeah, right. And what are the first few hours or days of that transition like?
So the first few days is very, very difficult. The first few hours isn't difficult because it's you're moving your gear into your campsite. You're kind of setting up. It's kind of exciting. It's all good. And then all of a sudden, as a matter of fact, my mode, when I get home tonight, I sit down with a computer. All of a sudden, you don't have a computer that you can sit down to do anything. I did take some books, so I had books to read, but reading a book is just seems sort of slow compared to my usual life. So the first 3 days is relatively hard, a little bit of withdrawal. And then I get into the mode and I get into the tempo. I get into the pace. I sleep more for the first few days. And that's because I'm probably chronically sleep deprived in my usual life. You start living with the sun. So I would be up when the sun goes up. I do have light at night so I can read and do some things after dark, but I don't stay up like I do tonight when I've got a computer and stuff I can do online. So start living more like that and start living a more physical life. To drink water, you have to go down to the lake, which is a couple hundred meters down, pull the water up the hill, put it through a water filter. Like it isn't like going and turning on the tap.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do sort of hiking and camping maybe once a summer, and that's probably the closest thing we get to something like that. And it's, you know, it's usually 3 or 4 days, not 3 weeks. But when you come back, what's that transition like? Because if you're anything like me, you're like, "Oh my God, this is the way to live. I'm gonna figure out ways to have mini monk modes in my life every day so that I don't slip back into my old habits." And man, it never takes. So what's that transition like, and are there ways you found to take monk mode little pieces of that back into your normal life?
So I try to bring back part of it, but when I come back, I tend to be all on mode. And that's because I had over 1,000 emails, right? I have over 1,000 emails, and I do feel this urgency. I'm a polite Canadian and need to read my emails and reply to them and stuff like that. So I did hop back into my old routine, but a part of me knew and said, "I want to stay there." And so for me, I have a meditation practice. So I would meditate and set that time aside. But just you asking me that right now, you know, I'm almost making a mental note. Gee, why don't I set aside a little more time? I also do digital fasts. What is a digital fast? I do not look at my phone. I don't open Google. If I want to know what the temperature is, I have to open the door and walk outside. But I do feel sometimes there's always this feeling, "Oh, I'm going to miss something. Someone's going to email me. Someone's going to text me. Someone's going to call me," and whatnot. But I've told people around me that I also do this digital fast, and that makes it easier so they don't think, "Oh, what's wrong with it? Oh, it's Jim. Jim's sick. How come Jim didn't reply to my email? It's, you know, it's been 24 hours.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had sort of a forced digital fast. I think it was maybe last last year, and I was going up to a friend's cottage on a boys' weekend. It's a water access cottage, so he left a boat at the marina. I hopped in the boat, and before I was even on land, I managed to drop my phone in the lake, and it was October, so I did go after it, but it was gone. And the thing that I remember is how uncomfortable it was for those first few hours. Like, how many times I was just reaching for my phone through habit. I'm at a cottage in the middle of nowhere. There's no reason for me to be on my phone, and all my closest friends in the world are with me. What possible reason could I have to have my phone? But it felt really weird and foreign. And I also noticed how much time the people around me spent on their phones when all of their best friends were already there with them. So yeah, just maybe you do it consciously every once in a while, but sometimes you get it forced upon you and it's like, man, this is really unhealthy. And of course, then I got back and went to the Apple store and spent $1,500 on a phone, and I was right back where I started.
Well, I've had that situation where I left my phone at the office and I've gone home and come back into the office to pick up my phone because I'm naked without it, yeah. Even though I shouldn't be. Part of it's my own, our own doing, because I set an people have an expectation that they send me an email, I'm going to reply, or if they call me, that I'll pick up. And so it's partly the expectation I set, but it is a very powerful, I had thought I would spend more time thinking about strategy and thinking about high level stuff. I didn't spend as much time as I thought I would. I did spend some, which is very healthy, but when you're off grid, everything takes a lot of time. A lot of time. I mean, I was cooking over a fire, and that means you have to go pull the branches out of the woods, and you have to cut them up with a manual saw and split them. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not like going home. You switch the switch and the stove goes on, and dinner's ready in no time. And I go into the fridge, which I didn't have, right? There's nothing in the fridge. So
it's interesting you mentioned that too, because I have that as well. And I have times where I'll go, you know, squat at one of my friends' cottages, and it's a 3 days for, you know, strategy by myself and think about what I want to do with my life and my business, et cetera. But I find sometimes when I'm out for a bike ride or a walk, I'm like, okay, this is my opportunity to start doing strategy and do some of the big picture thinking you were talking about. But it's the last thing I want to do. Like, I'm supposed to be here present, and it's almost like it's two very different parts of my brain that I need. And so I think that I'm there to do this big picture thing, and sometimes I just let my mind wander, and the last thing I think about is business. So yeah, it's interesting. I've experienced that too.
I mean, you're talking a little bit about physical. I find I can only think if I'm walking, it's fine. If I'm running, if I get my heart rate up to a certain, my brain doesn't work anymore. I have one choice. My body works or my brain works. It's not both.
Yeah. Before, I wanted to ask you one last thing on this. What is the 20-second rule?
Well, the 20-second rule is if you put a 20-second barrier between you and doing something you don't want to do, you're less likely to do it. And if you put make something 20 seconds easier, then it makes it easier. So for example, my chocolate chip cookie example is an example. I actually could have chocolate chip cookies tonight. I suspect there's butter. I know there's butter. I know there's flour. I don't know if there's chocolate chips. I could have sugar cookies. There's sugar. But the barrier stops me from doing it. So if I know I want to work out on Saturday, I wake up in the morning, I put on my workout clothes. It's just one less barrier to working out because I'm already in the clothes. And if I want to go someplace else, I say, I have to change into something else because I didn't want to go out in my workout clothes. Oh, I may as well just work out. So if you can put a barrier between yourself or reduce a barrier between yourself, I've even heard that works with wine. Dampy makes wine coolers, but if you have wine that you put in the basement, you're less apt to drink it than if it's sitting in your kitchen. If you you have a cork that you need a corkscrew and you put your corkscrew in the basement, then you're just a little less likely than the screw top sitting on the counter. It works in a lot of things. It would work with any bad habit as well. I mean, if you simply said you're going to leave your cigarettes in the car and you have to go up in the car, especially weather like this, that's a barrier.
Yeah. Man, that's so true. I'm going to think more about that. I can certainly tell you, as the father of two teenage boys, you put something in the back of the fridge, it might as well be on Mars. Because even if they see it, they're not going back there. they're going to survive on the stuff that's right in the front of the fridge or the front of the cupboard.
Well, it definitely applies to eating. So what do I eat? We eat what is easy. It's easy to take the peanuts or the potato chips because just open it and there. It's tough to even take the carrots, which have to be peeled and cut up. But make it easier. Peel them, cut up, leave them there.
Yeah.
We all listen to that 20-second rule.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. You know, it's interesting. So yeah, like I said, I got introduced to you through Monk Mode. I'm like, oh, that guy's interesting. And then we agreed to, you know, have this conversation here. And I did a bunch of research on you. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's a really big deal. And it's so interesting because it's, in a lot of ways, it's kind of what this podcast is about, because if it wasn't for this podcast, you and I wouldn't be talking. And it's really just my selfish opportunity to talk to people that I'd never normally talk to. But it's interesting that, you know, you and I probably live within 40 kilometers of each other. We could live our entire lives and our Venn diagrams would never overlap. And when I talk to people about, oh yeah, I'm having Jim Esteel on the podcast, they're like, oh my God, yeah, I saw him here. And you're a big deal. You're a household name in certain circles, but our circles have never crossed until now.
Yeah. 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah. There you go. So anyway, that was a long-winded way of saying I was really, there's a lot about your kind of journey that I want to dig into that I hadn't been aware of. You started your first company right coming out of university, I think, called EMG Data Systems. So that's where kind of your entrepreneurial journey started. I'm curious, like, where did you get the confidence as a, 22-year-old guy to start a computer company?
Well, when you're 22, you don't know anything. So you think you can do everything, you see. I just wasn't smart enough. So I'm an engineer. I wanted a computer. Back then, computers were very expensive. I got a better deal if I bought two of them. So I bought two and sold one. And then someone else wanted one. So I bought another couple. And then someone wanted a printer, and then a disk drive, and then some memory. So that's the business that I started, buying, selling computer hardware, software, and peripherals. And that's the business I eventually built to a couple billion dollars in sales. So that was my entrepreneur start. And then once I have been an entrepreneur for that, it ruins me for being anything but an entrepreneur. Once you're an entrepreneur, you can't work for anybody, really. Right. Although when I sold my business, I did work for the company that bought mine for 5 years. I did want a corporate gig. So I did have that little corporate gig for 5 years. And I sat on the board of Danby Appliances after I retired and the CEO resigned. I said, I can go in and run it for a while. I started to run it and said, oh, that's what I want to do. I want to run a business. And then the ownership group asked me to sell it. And I said, how much for? And they told me, and I said, fine, I'll take it. That's how I ended up owning Danby Appliances.
Right. Well, I do want to come back to that. But before we do that, you were also, I think, a founding board member of BlackBerry back in 97.
Yeah.
And before it went public. And of course, that was about a $20 billion company at that time. And I think it was starting to slow doing, you know, because the iPhone was coming out, et cetera. But that's such an interesting trajectory. There's not very many people that get to see the inside of a company grow like that, be part of that kind of phenomenon. And I'm just wondering what you remember about that.
Yeah. So when I joined them, they weren't a $20 billion company. When I joined them, right, they probably weren't even doing $100 million. They were, as a matter of fact, I was the big company. They were the small company, which is why they asked me to join their board.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And so, I joined the board. They went public. I was on that board for 13 years. Tons of learning on it. First, the early board members were more product-centric, and the board was more involved in, you know, okay, let's add this feature, that feature, and whatnot. Then over time, it became more of a governance board as the company succeeded. Highly, highly successful company. I left the board in 2010, I guess. I mean, what are the learnings? Be careful as you grow that you don't become arrogant. I think there was an arrogance factor kicked in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just because you have the power doesn't mean that you should rub people's noses in it, because it builds resentment that all of a sudden it gives an opening for someone else to come in and take market. So BlackBerry at the time, they were the main king. And they didn't necessarily treat the telcos well. And then Apple came in and said to the telcos, you know, we'd like to do something. And the telcos were open to it because they weren't, they were using that that power. High growth creates inefficiency, maybe necessary inefficiency. But at one point they were hiring 100 people a month or 200 people, right, 500. People didn't know what they were doing. And so there was some of that. As a company starts to decline, it's really difficult because you lose your best people. Mm. You don't keep the A-plus players. You tend to keep the C players. And so it makes it very tough. Although BlackBerry's far past that, so BlackBerry actually does have a chance of doing something good again. But when they went through the decline, it was very difficult because they're losing their good people. As a business grows, you outgrow people too. So if you have someone who's a great, whatever, when there's 100 people, maybe they're not great when there's 1,000 people.
Yeah, that mix of talent that you need to start out and then to go through that kind of scaling. I can't imagine there's a elegant way to grow that quickly. Like you said, it's just going to become extremely bloated and inefficient. But you're right. I mean, I grew up in this town and I think 200 a month was conservative. I mean, they were hiring so many people, and you can't swing a dead cat in this town without talking to somebody that was a regional VP of something or other at BlackBerry. And those people eventually, when BlackBerry started laying off 2,000 people a month, they went out into the corporate world and, hey, I was a VP at BlackBerry, blah, blah, blah. And you realized, yeah, some of them were really good, but some of them were just there at the right time. And there's a lot of really interesting lessons that came out of that.
But the interesting thing is Waterloo recovered.
Yeah.
So at the time you're thinking, how do you, I don't know how many people, it's 5,000. It was a lot of people that went out, and now Waterloo is an extremely vibrant area. And so it spawned a lot of other businesses and it spawned a lot of ecosystem. Actually, speaking of founding, I was a co-founder of Communitech.
Yes.
That now has 1,000 businesses or members.
Before we leave BlackBerry, did you see the movie?
I did.
And what struck you about that?
Well, it's a movie, so they need to have an entertainment value. What they did was they exaggerated everybody's personality.
Yeah.
You know, if you were on the movie, I would make it so that your flannel shirt that you're wearing now is brighter colored and tattered, or you know what I mean? I'd make it so that your hair is an inch longer and your headsets are even bigger. So they made everybody, they exaggerate everything. The other thing, and I understand they needed a story, that the story they missed during that time frame, that was the exciting thing, but maybe it wasn't the exciting for a movie, is BlackBerry had $600 million in cash. BlackBerry lost a $600 million lawsuit. And the sum, I think, was $617 million for a company that had $600 million. So I was on the board, and you're like, it's like me. I sue you, Bob, and I say, okay, Bob, I won, or I give me all of your assets. It's like, what do you own? I'll take it all. And that's the way BlackBerry, but within 3 or 4 quarters, they were making $1 billion in a quarter. So they made it all back. But it was a very frightening or scary time. And it wasn't even brought up in the movie at all, which I understand you can only cover so many topics. So,
yeah, of course. Yeah, I've talked to a number of people. It's just a very unique perspective. It's not very often you get to see the inside of a phenomenon like that and then see Hollywood's kind of glamorized version of that and get to compare the two. So yeah, super interesting. So after you sold the original company, you founded a media company, right? Digital media company, and then sold that. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that was an interim. I had moved to New York and I wanted to have a stint in New York. So I moved to New York for 5 years, but then my dad got sick. So I moved back quickly and I wanted sort of a hobby business. So that's when I started the digital media, SEO company.
Right.
And, but I sat on the board of Danby Appliances. And when I ended up buying Danby Appliances, I didn't really want to have digital media. You know, you can't run two companies at the same time.
Right.
So I switched horses to Danby. So that's why I sold that one.
I'd love to hear more about that. So you start this computer company, wildly successful. You exit from there. You start another company. If you don't mind me saying, appliances is not the sexiest thing that you would imagine you'd do next. So how do you go from tech and SEO to selling freezers and fridges?
Well, I backed into it. I just happened to be on the board. And when I started running Danby, I realized I like running a company. I don't want to say of scale because Danby's a small company, but it's still big enough to have heft, if you know what I mean. Hundreds of employees and hundreds of millions of dollars of sales. What I found when I was doing the interim stuff is small company, like digital media and stuff like that, is you could decrease expenses by 10%. You save $10,000 or $20,000, where the advantage of a $400 million company, you save 10% on expenses, you're talking big dollars. You can save $4 million. You increase sales by 10%, that's $40 million. So I kind of like the scale of Danby. I also saw the slowness of the appliance industry and the speed of the tech industry and thought if I could add some of the speed of the tech industry to the appliance industry, that would be cool.
Well, yeah, so $400 million might sound like a smaller company to you. Doesn't sound like a small company to me.
well, it's not huge. I mean, the other thing you do is put it in scale with who are we competing with?
Yeah,
we're competing with Whirlpool, $10 billion, competing with Samsung, LG, $30 billion. I actually like being a distance apart from my competitors size-wise. So if you came to me with $1 million appliance opportunity, I'll give you the A-plus player, the A-string. We'll look at $1 million opportunity. You go to LG with $1 million opportunity, they're going to say, well, we'll send a summer intern.
Yeah.
So I like not being identical size. It's one of my strategies almost.
Yeah, and I guess then you can get super surgical about the kinds of customers that are a really good fit for you, because you're as important to them as they are to you. Sure, maybe they could go to Whirlpool and get a better price, but they're a tiny fish in a giant pond. They're never going to get their attention. And so you're trying to, you know, find that customer that really appreciates what makes you different.
In those cases, actually, they come to us because we're actually lower price. So we're actually a value brand. So we tend to price ourselves as a value brand, but we don't have the same overheads that those companies have either. So that's the other trick, is to keep your overheads. I mean, we're in Guelph. We're not even in Toronto. Like, that's where other people think, oh, right. I'm located in Canada. Oh, let's go to Toronto. Well, no, I don't have an office tower in Toronto. We're in Guelph.
You mentioned bringing some of the speed of tech to appliances. What does that look like?
I mean, what's top of mind for me right now is tariffs. And if tariffs happen, I believe we can react faster than our competitors can around pricing, around ordering, around filling our warehouses in the States before the tariff comes in and stuff like that. So it's all about the little speed things. And speed has served us well in e-commerce. Your expectation, you place an order for a bar fridge today, you expect it the next morning. You don't expect it a week later. So our .com customers like Amazon and Wayfair and whatnot, we have a little bit of an edge there. So mostly what we deal with is micro-competitive advantage. It's not one huge thing. It's a bunch of little things.
Interesting. So you look at this journey that you've been on as an entrepreneur, and you've written a couple of books, and I'd like to touch on those later. But if you were going to write a book now about this journey that you've been on, the successes, the scars, what are some of the lessons you've learned along the way that just seem to be universal, whether you're in tech, whether you're in appliances? What would you say to that?
So I have a lot of axioms and sayings that I repeat. One of them is accept failure, and I have a company that wants to have failures. So fail often, fail fast, fail cheap, or having a failure does not make you a failure. So I actually want to introduce products and find out, oops, that didn't work, as opposed to not trying. The other fact is the difference between an engaged employee and a employee is triple. So you want someone who wants to help the company, as opposed to wants to punch the clock for 40 hours. And unintentionally, the way I learned this is through charity, philanthropy. People are inspired because we do good with the money we make. And then people say, I want to work for that company. And so that gets people more engaged, as opposed to saying, you know, we want to sell more wine coolers so that Jim can have a jet. That's not as inspiring as, oh, we're going to help save the world by selling more wine coolers.
Well, I really like that. Yeah, an engaged employee is three times as more productive. That's just something that I think so many companies struggle with. You mentioned the philanthropy side. So let's dig into that. That's one of the things that you've been known for. You've been vocal about companies taking a bigger role in that. So how did that come about? Is that something you've always felt, or is it something you kind of stumbled into?
So I always felt a need to try to help and give back. But when you start a business, you have no money. So I didn't give back much to start with, other than, you know, a few walkathon sponsorships and the little stuff. And then after I sold my business, I had money. I actually became a little depressed because I achieved my goal. Once you achieve your goal, you have nothing. I didn't understand, because I was too young, that success is the journey. It's not the destination, where I thought I had arrived. Mm. And because I didn't need to work financially, I didn't have fire in my belly. And I don't know how I arrived at it, but I said, okay, so money also, you need a certain amount of money because of security. The money beyond that, you should give it all away. So that's what I decided. I'm going to give away everything above a certain line. And then I gave a lot to a lot of different causes, like hospice and hospital and homelessness and stuff like that. And that was good. It was. And then this refugee thing happened, Syria. and I had a budget. I agreed to sponsor 50 Syrian refugee families, and the press got a hold of it. And that was purely an unintended consequence. And once the press got a hold of it, I became the poster child of refugee. So I kept doing some of that refugee work. The second unintended consequence of that was, it's actually a secret. I go to business groups, meetings, and people say, oh, what's your biggest problem? Oh, I can't hire people, And I sort of sit there and don't say anything. I get one resume a week or a day of unsolicited people want to work for us. And that's an unintended consequence. Mm-hmm. I don't have that. And in a weird way, it even helps with turnover because people see that the company's doing good and work here. So it creates an engagement. So that was how that happened. And then once you're bringing in refugees, you need furniture. So we started the furniture bank, which supplies all the furniture and housewares for those in need. We don't just do refugees. We do any newcomers. We do people coming out of homelessness. And that I like is a multiple bottom line because we're saving things from landfill and reusing them. That's one bottom line. And the other thing is you're helping people. And if I toured you through, remember, Bob, if you're down in Guelph, just give me a shout and I'll tour you through. You'd be impressed. The quality of the furniture, a lot of it comes from estates. If you didn't have anything, I could set you up and you would think, wow, this is really nice couch, nice dining room table, nice pots and pans and dishes and everything.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. So, yeah, you mentioned sponsoring the 50 refugees from Syria. Yeah, you're right. That did get a lot of press. So when you get out, you obviously get, you're interviewed, you get asked to talk about that. I'm wondering what reaction you get from other business leaders. Like what did you hear from them about why they wanted to do it? But, oh yeah, that's great that it worked for you, Jim, but we could never do that. Like, what's your response to that?
I am generally quite disappointed in business leaders. Business leaders tend to not be very charitable. That's the bottom line. And that's because we're all trained that success in business is making lots of money. And we also are in a consumerist world. So people say, oh, isn't it great? I've got a new Maserati. I've got a new Porsche. And so there's a consumerism that happens. So I've been disappointed generally in companies. The reason companies should be involved in the type of charity that we were doing is companies know how to organize things. So that, settling 50 families was a big deal, but we've gone on to settle like 1,000. So it's been lots, but every family that comes in needs 4 or 5 mentor families to get the bus pass, set up the bank account, ride the bus with them, register the kids in school, find a doctor, find a dentist, find a place to stay, set it up with the furniture. Like there's a whole checklist people go through. That's a business type thing because you don't run a business without doing checklists and without doing scorecards and without having system and process. And many of the churches do a lot of this stuff, but they may or may not be business people capable of setting it up. Plus the financial end of it. Many times churches say, oh, I'm going to raise money. I'm going to do a bake sale. And that's great. You raise $300. Often the scale isn't the same as what a business scale could be.
That's so interesting. And I imagine it's hard to quantify the ROI of that. If, you know, making a return on your stakeholders' investment is your number one priority, which it largely is, you know, you can talk about engagement, you can talk about talent retention and acquisition, but it's kind of a dotted line between that. Like I don't know if there's a credible ROI story that a traditional business leader is going to buy.
Well, and if you do it for ROI, then you probably wouldn't, you shouldn't.
Right.
It's the bottom line. And as a matter of fact, it's not even from your heart.
Right.
If you say you're going to help that little old lady going across the street, like, if you're doing it because that gets you something, then you're not really a charitable guy, right? Where if you're doing it not thinking anyone's going to see you and not thinking that you're – so, no, you don't do it for business reasons. I would say, though, the press and the brand, I would say there's more people that know Dan B. and have a warm feeling towards Dan B. than didn't before those projects.
Yeah.
It's not perfect, but if you were to buy a Dan B. product, I mean, we sell 2 million appliances a year. You know, when you sell 2 million appliances, some of them are we're going to mess up somehow. So you get one that doesn't work or has a problem. If you know me, you know us, you're not going to go and flame me on social media. You're going to say, oh, I got this product that doesn't work. And you give people the latitude, if you know what I mean. This is what I tell young people who, how do you get ahead in business? If you have, or in life, show up to work 15 minutes early and leave 15 minutes late, you're ahead of 99% of the other people.
Yeah. Well, I want to circle back on something you said earlier, Jim, because it's something that I talk to a lot of people about these days, and you didn't call it purpose, but you mentioned that you obviously made money early in your life. There's a great kind of story that Matt Damon tells. Him and Ben Affleck, the very first thing they ever did in Hollywood was wrote Good Will Hunting, and it won an Oscar. And he talks about how grateful he is that that happened early, because most people work their entire careers to do that. A, most of them never get it. And even the ones that do, it happens so late in their life. And then they get that goal, like you talked about, and nothing changes. And so maybe it's a blessing in disguise that it happened so early for you. But I'm wondering how you think about this idea of purpose, because I know a lot of people that are thinking about, okay, so I had this career and I did what was expected of me and everything went fine, but I feel like I'm supposed to be finding my purpose and I can't figure it out. How do you think about purpose?
So if you can say you absolutely know your purpose, good on you. And I love it. Fact is, you actually are working within your purpose. You maybe just don't have, haven't clarified it in your mind so you could put it on a one sentence statement. So you actually are doing some of it. So I wouldn't beat yourself up too hard. It's kind of like meditation. I meditate and I'm terrible at it.
Right.
But the more you know your purpose, the more powerful you can be, because working and doing things within your purpose gives you energy, gives you power, reduces your stress. If you do things that aren't within your purpose, that's what causes stress. At the same time, there's some things you have to do. You actually have to make enough to feed your family, and you have to, there's certain things you have to do. But the more you know your purpose, the more powerful you can be, the more you know yourself. And I think my early business success turned me into a philosopher. Mm. I'm going to say in the tough time after I arrived. And you're going to say, what do you mean tough time after you arrived? You had money. Yeah, but it wasn't fulfilling because I had arrived. And then that's what turned me into the philosopher that I am today, with the multiple philosophies.
Ah, sure. So I love that, Jim. One of the things that I think about too is that I think the happiest people in life are the ones that understand that it's the pursuit of happiness where they find joy, knowing that they will never find it. Like you said, it's not the destination. It really is the journey. And once you accept that the destination isn't going to probably bring you everything you expect, you've got to find a way to enjoy the journey. And so, yeah, maybe I don't know my purpose, but the pursuit of trying to figure it out is what's actually really rewarding, and it maybe I never find it, and that's okay.
You're absolutely correct. The journey should be the goal, not the destination. But the other interesting thing that we all do is we move the goalposts. I move the goalposts. Mm. Like when I was in university, I wanted to start a business that did $100 million in sales. And when I'm doing $75 million, I said, I meant $200 million. And then when I'm doing $200 million, I meant $500 million. And then I said, if I could do $1 billion, this is just, I will have arrived. And then I did $2 billion. So I went beyond, and that's quite normal with money. People often say, you know, if I have $1 million, I'll retire. And then they get $1 million, and they say, no, I meant $2 million. And this is the psychological problem that many wealthy people have. I have a lot of friends who are 100 millionaires or billionaires, and they need to make more money. Well, think about how silly that is. Like, you can only eat so much. You can only, yes, you can own a lot of things, but you only need so much. But there's people who are worth $1 billion that need to make more money. It's ego beyond that.
Yeah. Is it ego, you think, that's at the heart of that?
I think it's ego, but it's also something that once you think that that's what you should be doing, you just, it becomes ingrained in you. And I had that a little bit that, you just need to do it. Whatever you did this month is not good enough. You need to do a little more next month. And you have to admit, it's not very inspiring to say, oh yeah, our sales are the same as last year. I mean, right. What's that all about? You're a loser.
Oh man, Jim, you've given me so much to think about. This conversation has exceeded my expectations. I would love to know, before we wind up, what are you most excited about for the next 10 years?
I guess I'm excited about using my wisdom instead of my work ethic. And I am of an age where I'm realizing that energy is finite, and it's very good to have my wisdom, or my resume, I'm almost going to say. People return my call because of what I've done. Where when you're small and starting up, nobody returns my call because nobody knows who I am. And everyone's, you're just an upstart. Now I can actually do that. And I can also focus on the things that get me more. At the same time, I'm nervous about being an old guy who says the sky is falling. It's just not like the old days. I'm very worried about the state of the world. And this is the wars that are happening and the leadership that's happening in the world. I just don't think it's healthy, but we'll survive it. So,
yeah. Well, and I love that. How can I use my wisdom instead of my work ethic, recognizing that energy is finite? Yes. And trying to figure out ways to do the most good with, given the fact that your people will pick up the phone. So who can I call? Who's going to pick up the phone? That's an amazing position to be in, and an amazing way to think about how to make the biggest impact on, the years you've got left.
That's right. And also accepting being a little more gentle on myself. I mean, I want to go out and make the $10 million sale, but maybe I won't. I used to kick myself up, beat myself up a lot if I didn't do that. Now I'm more philosophical.
Well, this has been just incredible, Jim. I can't thank you enough for being here. I didn't know where this conversation was going to go. It went down some really interesting rabbit holes I didn't expect. I just can't tell you how many things I'm going to take away from this to soak on. And I know it's going to create some really interesting conversations with the founders I work with, my friends. Just, you're right. There is a lot of wisdom there. And I'm so grateful that you shared it with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.